The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Welcome back to Banking Weekly with me, Patrick Jenkins. This week, Franco-Belgian lender Dexia has been forced into emergency talks on options to save itself, including an effective breakup.
It looks like implicitly or explicitly there will be a bad bank which receives guarantees from the Belgian and French governments.
Banks are being forced to think the unthinkable as regulators begin forcing the world's largest institutions to write living wills that would make it easier to stabilize them or wind them down in a crisis.
Some of it is as simple as who has the Microsoft Word license, and some of it is as complicated as here's how we would wind up our trading book if we had to shut ourselves down tomorrow.
Swiss bank UBS has said it still expects to make a third quarter profit despite a $2.3 billion unauthorized trading loss. And finally, we round up on the quarter's M&A activity.
Global debt issuance reached levels not seen since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which is quite a shocking stat in itself.
Joining me this week is the FT's chief regulation correspondent, Brooke Masters, M&A correspondent, Anusha Sakui, and by phone from Brussels, our correspondent, Stanley Pignal. First off, the Franco-Belgian lender Dexia. Now, this is not a household name, but they are a big bank. And Stanley Pignal, our Brussels correspondent, is on the line to tell us exactly what's gone wrong there. Why is Dexia in emergency talks to save itself from collapse?
Dexia, Patrick, is essentially a European sovereign lending specialist in the middle of an extended European sovereign debt crisis.
That's not the place to be. Yeah.
No, exactly. So Dexia specialized in loans to local government, and ultimately that meant it took on a lot of sovereign and sub-sovereign exposure, which is, as you say, is really not a good place to be in right now. Ultimately, it was bought down by two things. On the funding side, Dexia is not dissimilar to Northern Rock for our British listeners.
So short-term funding, long-term commitments.
Short-term funding, long-term loans. It was trying to fix the situation since 2008 when it got a first bailout from the French, Belgian, and Luxembourgish government. But ultimately, it still has $96 billion of short-term funding it needs to roll over. And that market, as you know, has been pretty difficult in the past few months.
Yeah, so no issuance by anybody really until last week, since June or so, in terms of the unsecured markets. And I guess Dexia was among those unable to tap the markets.
Exactly. On top of that, on the capital side, things were looking pretty grim as well. It has over $20 billion of sovereign bonds of southern European countries. It was looking at haircuts on the Greek stuff already.
Holdings are in excess of its total equity base, I gather.
Yeah, that's right. So the tangible equity was rapidly eroding, and any mark-to-market on its Italian bond holdings, for example, would have sent its tangible equity below 5 billion euros.
So what's the plan now?
The plan now is... It looks like it's going to be essentially what amounts to a breakup of the bank. Mm-hmm. On one hand, you would have French state bodies taking on French municipal lending because that has systemic importance. On the other hand, there are still a lot of healthy assets that Dexia has. It has a well-regarded asset management arm. It has a Turkish retail network, Denizbank. It has investor services. All those things are worth money, and it looks like they're going to be sold off to essentially finance the runoff of a portfolio of troubled assets, which Dexia got from its pre-2008 days.
So it all sounds like it can be managed down in a fairly methodical way, but will there be any ramifications for the broader European banking industry or global banking industry? Because no bank seemingly can fail or be wound down without some kind of knock-on effects.
Mm. I mean, it looks like implicitly or explicitly there will be a bad bank which receives guarantees from the Belgian and French governments. Now, any guarantees from the... We don't know what they look like yet, but that could put additional strain on their credit rating. France has still got this this AAA credit rating, which is crucial to its Eurozone bailout strategy. If it were to lose that, or any threat of losing that, would make it think very carefully about what actions to take around Dexia.
Right.
The other issue is around the municipalities themselves. Dexia is a huge player in the U.S., where it basically helps to bolster the credit ratings of municipalities who want to borrow money on the markets. It is leaving the market. That lending has really dried up.
Yeah.
That could have huge impact on municipalities in the U.S., but it's still a little bit too early to tell at this stage.
Okay, Stanley, thank you very much for your thoughts on that. Well, if any reminder were needed that living wills and planning for the demise of banks were needed, then Dexia gives us one. That topic of living wills is uppermost in regulators' minds at the moment. The world is starting to force leading financial institutions to write those living wills, plans effectively on how they could be broken up in the event of a crisis. Brooke Masters has been looking closely at this latest development. Brooke, what exactly happened? Because this has been in the works for months and months, hasn't it?
Exactly. But the Financial Stability Board, which is a group of central bankers and regulators that tends to set policy and send ideas off to the group of 20 leading economies, has just come out yesterday with its latest pronouncement, which is that all big banks, anything that's cross-border and big enough to be scary, will be forced to write these. They're called resolution and recovery plans, is the fancy regulator speak for them. And they basically said by the end of 2012, anything that's big enough to possibly require extra capital charges will have to write these plans. And what they basically are.
So this is what we think, close to 30 of the world's biggest banks, basically.
Yes, and many countries are going to force their smaller banks to do it as well. But this is the global agreement is that the roughly 30 and possibly even 40, if the on-the-cusp banks are required, will have to do this. And it's a two-part plan. First one is the recovery plan. It's a secret plan. What would you do if your bank got into trouble? You know, what would you sell? What country would you exit? Who is likely to buy you? And that is actually one of the most sensitive parts, because admitting that, in fact, I'd really like to sell my asset management arm to Morgan Stanley is not something that Barclays wants to say publicly.
Hence the secret nature.
Yeah.
So where will these plans be kept? In a vault somewhere?
Well, they're supposed to be kept in a vault, but they're also supposed to be kept updated all the time. So it's really unclear how this is going to work. And the second half of the plan is much more a how-to model for regulators. Like, okay, we've just gone bust. You've walked in the door. Where is everything? And how do we break it up? And some of it is as simple as who has the Microsoft Word license, and so where does it go? And some of it is as complicated as here's how we would wind up our trading book if we had to shut ourselves down tomorrow. And as part of the exercise, they have to do that. They have to instantly try to wind up their trading book and figure out what kind of losses they would take.
And this initiative is basically the big lesson learned from Lehman Brothers when it was such chaos. Nobody knew where to find stuff. Nobody knew what to do.
And actually, what's interesting is the U.S. regulators, who fundamentally caused the crisis by shutting Lehman Brothers down, have started saying, look, we recognize that by shutting all the overseas operations with nothing and giving them no cash at all, we lost money for our taxpayers. And we now know it's in our interest to keep these overseas bits alive to see if we can sell them off to someone and recover money. And so everyone thinks that the Lehman experience has finally forced everyone to think that you can't just grab assets in insolvency, that in fact it's better to keep the whole thing going enough until you can break it up and sell it off.
So to recap on what's happening now, this is in advance of November's G20 meeting. The global regulators have come together and are kind of finalizing the plan for the next stage of drafting these living wills, setting a deadline.
And setting standards. They will be like, standards. This is what has to be in this plan. And this is, you know, you can't say we're doing living wills and then not do anything. This is what you're supposed to be doing. One of the roughly 30 banks that this will apply to is UBS, which hopefully has absolutely no need of a recovery plan at this moment. But it did announce today that it's hoping to make a profit despite having suffered an enormous unauthorized trading loss.
Yeah, now UBS, as you say, is one of the banks that's going through a lot of ructions at the moment. It might voluntarily choose to restructure itself. And indeed, we're expecting to hear in the next few weeks that it's going to shrink its investment banking operations quite dramatically. But on that point, they've tried to reassure the market in the wake of that trading loss and after the departure of their chief executive Oswald Grubel, that they're still profitable. They've put out a trading update early today, saying that they expect to make a small net profit and that they're still bringing in new money into their wealth management business. I think they're desperately trying to prove they're still on an even keel. The key question now, I think, is, you know, what do they come up with in terms of a plan for restructuring the bank? Can they keep together the universal structure, so the retail and wealth management on one side with the investment bank? Or will the pressure from Swiss politicians to shrink back to Switzerland, as basically happened to some degree with Britain's big bailed out bank, RBS, when it was saved and forced to restructure? And I suppose the other big question everyone's asking is, who do they have as a new chief executive? The interim incumbent is Sergio Motti, who came in only a few months ago from UniCredit, has been swiftly pushed into the top job. And we'll be looking to see over the next few months whether he can hold on to that role or whether somebody else comes in. So, yes, this is a story that will be evolving. Maybe less dramatically than it has done over the last few weeks, but certainly it'll be a big story for the next 6 months. Finally, let's move on to the M&A story. Anusha, you've been looking back at the third quarter numbers and the volume of deals and the amount of money that's raised for all the big investment banks, not least UBS, but others as well. And to what extent M&A activity has offset, I suppose, the poor trading environment. Who were the big winners and the losers in the quarter?
Well, overall, it has to be said, it's been a very disappointing quarter, mainly because, you know, the sovereign debt crisis, and sorry, you can't really sort of just describe it as European anymore, because during the last quarter, there were the issues about the US debt ceiling and the credit rating downgrade. So that really had a massive impact on capital markets, which had generated a lot of activity for banks and fees, and those shut down. So global debt issuance reached levels not seen since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which is quite a shocking stat in itself. And as a result, investment banking fees hit lows not seen since the first quarter of 2009, so just, you know, months afterwards. So you know, really what had started as quite a positive year with corporates, you know, being in a very strong position and suddenly ramping up and, you know, either raising equity or, you know, buying other companies, sort of ground to a halt in the summer, and banks are suffering as a result. And whilst in 2010, the first half was quiet because of the Greek crisis, and the second half picked up, which then followed through to 2011, the second half of 2011 is likely to be fairly quiet, as, you know, the volatility around Europe continues, and it continues to create uncertainty for companies, and uncertainty is the enemy of M&A. And yeah, so it's likely to remain fairly muted.
So were there any winners within that muted environment?
JP Morgan came out top in terms of fee generation amongst all the banks, which is not surprising in a way, because they have they're probably not alone, but they're one of the banks that has been quite successful in using their balance sheet to win advisory business. So they're quite famously, if you like, now with the biggest deal of the year, AT&T and T-Mobile, buying T-Mobile off Deutsche Telekom. You know, they sole underwrote a massive $20 billion debt facility to allow that deal to take place. And so then those kinds of deals can be very juicy for banks.
But as you say, until the broader environment improves, we're probably not going to get quite so many of them over the coming months.
Well, there's some activity going on in the background, but I wouldn't expect anything too exciting.
No buttons being pressed yet.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to Anusha and to Brooke and to Stanley. Banking Weekly was produced by Emily Cadman. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vodari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.